following talk was delivered by Jim Meagley on Sunday, February 14th, 2010, at the Community Center in Hobart, New York. The presentation was accompanied by a series of maps and notes, and these are available at northerncatskillshistory.com. Please download these maps and have them available as you listen to this presentation. The podcast is copyright by James Meagley and is available for free, nonprofit use, courtesy of Jim and the Hobart Historical Society. Please send any feedback on this presentation to Hobart@northerncatskillshistory.com, and we will share your information with both Jim and the Hobart Historical Society.
Just to introduce our speaker, Jim Meagley. Jim gave our wonderful talk last year. So happy to come back this year. Jim is very important to this talk today in two ways. Number one is that he provided the photographs and put together the calendar, as was already mentioned. Actually, three things. Number two, he's giving the talk. Number three, if there are any undocumented aliens here, you're in the right place, because Jim is an attorney and he deals with immigration law. He's the guy to know, the guy to come to. Jim grew up here, and his mother's here, June. There's June. And of course, the Meagleys had the pharmacy here in town for, actually, I have dates here. I don't know if these are inclusive dates, if they're accurate. 1957 to 1989.
Yep.
Pretty close.
That's right.
And, but anyway, Jim, it's great to see you back, and I'll get out of your hair.
Go right ahead. Thanks very much, and boy, it's great to see everybody. Can you hear me in the back? We've got a microphone, but I prefer not to use it. But if you can't, please just raise your hand as you go along if I talk too softly. But also, I do have, I hope we got enough, there's a handout I'm going to follow. So hopefully if you all have one, or if you don't, you can share. There were 60 made. It looks like we may be close to 60, but we're going to follow along in the handout. So anybody don't have one or can't see one? Okay. First, it's great to be here, and it's very nice to see everybody. A lot of old friends. As Bill mentioned, I did grow up here. I've been living in the Buffalo area since 1974. I graduated from high school here in 1970 from South Courtright. But my parents have lived here the whole time. I've been back and forth regularly. And I've gotten more active the last, as Barbara mentioned, I joined the Hobart Historical Society, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. I've been active. Because I'm in Buffalo, I can't attend the monthly meetings as such, but I do help with the calendar the last few years, and I've been doing, on my own, I've been doing Hobart research of Hobart, and we did one presentation last year that was well received, and from, you know, hopefully today I won't disappoint you either. We've got some good stuff here, and we'll get going. I'll try to keep it. I think, what do we got, Bill? 45 minutes, an hour, 4 o'clock or so.
An
I mean,
hour, but of course, the question and answer.
Yeah, no,
indefinitely.
We'll keep it informal. Just raise. I mean, we got a lot of people, so if you got a quick question as I go along, you know, just raise your hand, and we'll try to answer as we're going. I'll try to leave some time toward the end for questions generally, and we're going to go along. There's a bunch of maps. The first four maps. On the right-hand side and the left-hand side, I've got comments for each map. Toward the back, the maps double up, and I don't have comments specifically written out for you. But, you know, the cover page, we're going to run from 1778, before anything was here in Hobart, up to the 1920s, more recent. So almost 150 years with some good examples of maps. And let's start with the first page, 2 and 3. And this is page 3 of the map, the northern frontier of New York State, roughly in the mid-1770s. I've got 1778 on here. It might be 1775. Most importantly, and I think I highlighted in yellow, there was a Fort Stanwix Treaty in 1768. And that was basically a treaty between the Indians and British or the white settlers here. And as of that date, east of the line, and that line runs all the way down the Unadilla River, down that left-hand side of the map, the area was opened up for settlement east of that. And basically, the Delaware County historians say there were pretty much, there were no regular white settlers in Delaware County before 1768. And that's, it was after that time that the settlement started, after this treaty. And so the first settlements were John Harper and Harpersfield, coming into our direction. Earlier than that, I mean, the Cherry Valley area and up along the Mohawk River had obviously been settled. But coming into Delaware County area, John Harper, Lawrence Courtright, and Goldsboro Banier had some of the biggest patents, and those were all on the other side of the Delaware River. As we talked through this, the Delaware River was a main boundary line for this area and ran right through the middle of Hobart, which creates some challenges as we try to do history research. Because Hobart was divided for many years in terms of territorial and government jurisdiction and so forth. But in the early days, and so this map, I mean, there's also, if you look at Otsego Lake, there's no Cooperstown yet. William Cooper comes to Cooperstown in 1786 and settles, brings his family in 1790. So Cooperstown starts later, too. Where Hobart's down in the, if you see the John Harper and Lawrence Courtright patents, right under that, there's an old, sort of an obscure patent by given to Aaron Bratt. We talked about this last year. That patent was issued in 1738. It was supposed to be on the Susquehanna River. Somebody screwed up and it ended up on the Delaware River. So it runs roughly today, if you think about it, if you drive out Route 10, just past Breezy Acres, right where the stream comes down there as you're going towards Stanford. It starts there and runs all the way down, not quite to Bloomville. And this map incorrectly shows it on both sides of the Delaware River. It's only on the Route 10 side. The side we're on here, on this side, was in the Hardenberg Patent. That wasn't resolved legally until the 1780s. So some maps show it like this as being on both sides, but it wasn't. Just to help you with perspective, if you see Banyar's Brook, that's Bloomville. That's the Wright Brook today, and that's the brook that runs into Bloomville. So you can see, the reason I started with this map is it shows clearly in 1778, it shows Roses Brook and Town Brook. So Roses Brook, we know, down in South Courtright, and Town Brook comes out of Township and runs through just on the village limits south into the Delaware River. So there was basically very little settlement in those days during the Revolutionary War. Now, since I was here last year, I found references to a book called The Mark of Honor, and it's written by a Canadian, published in 1965, and it's written about loyalists in America, loyalists of New York State, and pretty much Delaware County and almost South Courtright, Hobart, Stanford area. There's a lot of references, which is really intriguing, who were here, settled here, mostly Scottish Highlanders, who came here, and there's a list on page 2. There's a list with some references, and this may not be precise because some different books and different historians have different locations, but I've tried to give you an idea of the 8 to 10 people maybe in this area from Stanford down to South Courtright. They were in the area before the Revolutionary War, settled in the early 1770s, and then for the most part were driven out during the war and were identified as loyalists, and many of them didn't come back and moved to Canada. And in basically, for me, in Buffalo, in the province of Ontario, which is just across the border, Niagara Falls and Buffalo. So a lot of them are right there, just north of where I live now. And so I found this book, and I hooked up with a Canadian who was interested in one of the people that lived in this area, that family genealogy. So he actually went, and the book's not available online anywhere. It's not available to buy so far. He went to a library in Canada and has sent me copies, emailed me copies, of excerpts from it. So I was able to look, and I've included some references here, but it makes some references to the Hobart area, which we'll talk about. But this sort of sets up, you know, at the Revolutionary War time. And so basically there's really no settlement. There are some references to people living near around this area in the town Brook. And so some of those loyalists, and the one that really interests me, and I haven't found any more, is toward the bottom of the list, is Jacob Stonebrenner. It looks with others, it looked maybe to be his sons, 500 acres on the Delaware River near Townbrook. I would guess that's running between Hobart and South Courtright along the Delaware River. I'm not sure. I mean, Hugh Rose, if people have done any research, Hugh Rose basically settled the South Courtright area along Rose's Brook. Rose's Brook is a name for the Rose family, and he was there. He befriended the Indians and some others, and he was the only one that stayed in the area during the Revolutionary War, and wasn't kicked out and was allowed to stay. Most of the others were kicked out and left. Any questions just about this early period? Yes. Well, listen, this, when I was here a year ago, I didn't know much about that. I just started to get into this. What I have found is, well, John Harper, Harpersfield basically, came from New England. And most of the people, and he attracted other people from New England. And I think I make reference to this in here somewhere. Yeah, the second paragraph. So most of it, they were second generation. The parents had settled in America. The people that started coming to Harpersfield were maybe the second generation by the time the war comes out. However, Lawrence Courtright, Pat, I read that Lawrence Courtright never set foot on this on the property. He lived in New York City. And Goldsboro Vanyard, I think, was New York City also. What they did is they got Scottish people right off the boats coming into New York City, and they settled. So it was first generation coming to the country. They were coming here in the 1770s. So only 3 or 4 years later, they were still loyal. They had more loyalty to the British Crown than some of the others. But it is, I know, and there were still some from Connecticut. I mean, some of these families out of Connecticut were loyalists, and they moved up here and seemed to settle in here for 10 or 12 years before anybody knew about it. And all of a sudden, then they moved to Canada for reasons not explained. But it is interesting, and I'm still checking, you know, I'm still looking at that, because I didn't realize. When you read this book, I didn't realize we had so many loyalists right in this area. There was a large concentration for small populations. Right. That's true. You're right. Let's go then. Well, moving on. The next map, we move along 10 years. The Revolutionary War is over. We're in the late 1780s. And they're looking in settlement. People in New England are moving west. They're moving out of New England. They're moving west into New York. For open territory and so forth. This is from the Cockburn Survey, and I talked about this last year. I maybe even included pretty much this map, but I wanted to put it in again. This is the town of Stamford. So the map, the Delaware River runs just as, and there's two parts here. I've included the top excerpt up here is from the field book notes. That's separate. The map is pretty much the whole page. And on the left side of it is the Delaware River. So the Cockburn Survey to the all the right is the town of Stamford, not the Route 10 side, but the town of Stamford, and it had been originally set aside for settlement in the 1760s. There was a survey done in the 1760s which was lost during the Revolutionary War, and for all there was very little settlement. And as of 1788, when this survey was done, five houses were on the properties, and I put X's in here for you. And on these maps, as we go through, if there's something circled, those are my comments. I've tried so you can identify what I've written in versus what the map had. What's interesting about this is you should see I've identified the bridge in Main Street to Maple Avenue and Hobart is in there. That was there. And the Route 10 side is the Paynes Mills. And then the excerpt is Painesdale. I'll talk a little bit about that. The Stamford side, which was called New Stamford under the new survey, had basically five houses, five settlements in 1788. And I've identified the lots for you, and they're marked here. Basically, lot 63 and 65, I'm not sure who that's up in Township, further up Township Road. And lot 69 was a Grant family. The Grants were one of the earliest ones. That's right at about Clove Road, if you're driving out Hobart, just as the first farm past the Clove Road, and there's an old cemetery in the woods there. It's labeled as the Truesdale Cemetery, but it's the old Grant family cemetery. And lot 70, just above that, was Alex Cumming, who married a Grant. These folks all sort of came in the 1780s or so. Lot 325 is on the back road to South Courtright, the rich family homestead, right where the river comes out of Clove Road, and that was Alex Grant's. I've made a reference to the Cowan homestead. I've circled in there. Hector Cowan came from Scotland and bought two large plots, 84 acres each in 1801. That, just to give you some parameters on you know, where that was. And then Hobart, I was going to try to show you, but Hobart roughly runs, the present day village of Hobart runs roughly from the corner of lot 76. So all the little triangles, the small little lots along the river were 15 acres each. The big rectangular ones were pretty much 84 acres, and number 76, sort of toward the top, was 84 acres. And at that corner, if you drew a line, that may be roughly the boundary of Hobart going out of the village towards Stamford, over by the river. Whiskey Hollow is a little bit maybe north of that. And if you go all the way down, all those river lots, down 76 along the top of the property lines of 70, 72, 73, and 117, that's 73 is the cemetery. So and I've circled, you've got a C there, and I've written in 73. That area is the present day Locust Hill Cemetery. So the village runs from that area toward the river. And I've written in, hopefully all of them, red ink is what I think is Pearl Street, running from the cemetery out toward the back road of Stamford. It runs right along that property line of the top of lots 73 and 72, which probably makes sense. And it may run along one of the property lines going toward the river, but I'm not sure about that. So, and there's very little written about this. I mean, I found this last year when to make my presentation here. I went up to the Albany in January, before I was here last February, the educational building, and pulled out it. And they have this, the Cockburn survey. When you get up there, it sits on a table twice this size. It's a huge, huge map. And I think there's one in the county clerk's office in Delhi. But I was amazed to see how big it is. I was able to get a digital copy made on a CD that I have, and I've been able to print it out. But it was done, basically, and all these names on here chose the names of the individual owners of each plot. Pretty much these were all folks from Stamford, Connecticut, some New York City. Very few of them ever settled here. I mean, if you notice Livingston, it's hard to read, and I apologize, but Livingston's name is throughout here. Robert Livingston from Livingston Manor along the Hudson River. He was a major investor in all of this. So very quickly, these lots turned over, and you will find very few of these people actually ever lived on any of these. They sold them. And that all started late 1780s, early 1790s. But what I didn't know when I went there last year, I'd never heard of Painesdale. And so that's the little excerpt, and it's Paines Mills on the map, but Painesdale is the excerpt. That's the Route 10 side of Hobart, right about where Adams Bookstore is. Again, you can see they've written bridge. So there's the bridge, and there's four or five buildings right there. There's the dam and the pond right where it is today. And that, as I reference over on page 2, Ezra Payne, who's from Connecticut, moves to the area. And so Painesdale is in Harpersfield in this period. You know, everything else we talked about, New Stamford is the town of Stamford. And actually different counties for a while. So the Delaware River was a very big dividing line. And so you have to, especially in this time, when you're doing research, you got to look in a lot of different areas. Because the information may be under different counties, different towns, whatever. There's very little written about Painesdale in the Delaware County histories. And very little in terms of any discussion. And so I did this mark of honor. I've put in three or four paragraphs, just some things in here, makes reference to it. It was Ezra Payne who, based on the obituary of his daughter Abigail, who married a local attorney here, in her obituary it says the family moved here in 1784 when she was about 10 years old. And that sounds about right. And her father, so Ezra started the mills in the 1780s, 84, 85. There's a reference that I mentioned last year of lumber being floated down. He had a grist mill and a sawmill, lumber being floated down from the sawmill from here to Walton on the river in 1786. Walton was being established about that time. And one of the first houses, wooden houses built in the county was in Walton, and it may have been from lumber made up here in the sawmill in Painesdale, Hobart. So it's fascinating. When you look at the Hobart history, you'll see reference to the names of Waterville, Tinkertown, then Hobart, very little about Painesdale. When I went back, after I found this, and when I went back, the Delaware County history book by Munsell in 1880 has some very obscure references to pathmasters, highway commissioners, being appointed for Painesdale. So it was in Harpersfield, and pathmasters were appointed basically to watch the roads for Painesdale. Ezra Payne was one early on, and then there was a Kenneth Chisholm. Those are names. Kenneth Chisholm was a name around here. So it was there. I think what basically happened is, as I mentioned last year, the Brad Patton, the Aaron Brad Patton, which ran from Breeze Acres down to Bloomville, in 1834, five big lots out of that were transferred out of the town of Harpersfield to the town of Stamford, basically covering the village of Hobart, roughly from Whiskey Hollow Road down past Gunhouse Hill Road. And so I think by the time the historians started, Painesdale was in Harpersfield in the 1780s, maybe 1790s, and then moved over in 1834. By the time the historians started writing in the 1860s, 1880s, it just somehow seems to have been forgotten. I don't know, you just don't find a lot. So I've been trying to find more. It's hard to find, but I keep trying. And this Mark of Honor book had some very interesting passages about it, referencing it. Any questions on these maps here? What I will mention, I don't know if we have people from township on this. It's just last year I showed more of it, but on this right here, this part right here, to say that this is what's called the town plot. When the town of Stamford was set up, New Stamford, the plan at that time for the folks in Stamford was the community was going to be set up in township. It was going to be the town. That roughly the town plot is, it's in the valley at the Narrow Notch area on the township road, and if you come out of that, the Narrow Notch road is, it meets what I call the road in township, is about the middle of the town plot. And it was a very elaborate, it was set up, it was I think 10 acre lots, I forget how big, and you can see a portion of it. It was a square, 1 mile square, and it never, you know, for whatever reasons, it never took off. It basically, the business stayed in Painesdale, and as you'll see on the next map, started to develop on this side, on the Stamford side. So now we move ahead another 10 years to 1800. This map, I mean, the Hobart Historical Society has put this map out. They did a red book, a history of houses in the area in 1988 in the village, and this map was in there. It's the first that I had seen it. In the bottom right-hand corner, it makes a reference to being the maps and streets, St. Peter's Church, an old map by Andrew Beers, about 1800. That seems right, but very quickly, I mean, the date, from what's here and what's not here, 1800, it could be the St. Peter's Church was built in the summer of 1801, and this picture also shows the tree in front of the church, which is an oak tree, which was the church history says was planted in 1802. So if this is accurate, now there's some questions about whether this map is accurate, because it shows five streets running from the church. Those of us that live here know, I mean, present day, there are three streets. And interestingly, it's in the middle of the comments on the page to the left, the St. Peter's Episcopal Church history references four streets at one time. And so it looks like, and I've made a note there, what I think may have been the fourth street running from today's Episcopal Church to the Methodist Church area. For those of us that live in the village and know that. The other three streets, I think the street that wasn't there is what's identified as going north as Chapel Street. So running from the church over to what they label as Water Street, today's River Street. The other streets, the Broadway running west, the Queen Street running south toward today's cemetery, and the Maiden Lane running over to Pine Street, I think probably are today's, pretty close to today's three streets. So, I mean, Andrew Beers was perhaps one of the more famous people that lived here in the early days. He was an astronomer. He published almanacs for almost 30, 40 years throughout the Northeast. And he was very accomplished. He was a lawyer. He was a surveyor. So he did a lot. His name is, along with George Foote, those two gentlemen, their names are all over everything in this early period of Hobart. So I would think that Andrew Beers would do something reasonably accurate, but why he showed five, maybe five streets were existing at that time, but the church says certainly there were four. So the map, if it's is probably around 1802. Now, I made a reference at the lower. Well, we got the upper dam. Let's stay with Painesdale. We talked about Painesdale, and I did a circle in there. So there's still four buildings there. Probably by this time, George Foote is running the mill. There's a reference that he has he had the hotel here, which may have been Leo's Pizza, the commercial hotel building. These buildings are about in that area. And George Foote was running it. He shows up, George and his son Bailey show up in the 1800 census in Harper's Field, so that side of the Delaware River, so that's consistent. Whereas at the bottom I show you that there's some names from that I think are Hobart that show up on the Stanford side. So Painesdale is still probably not called Painesdale now. I'm still looking. There's a reference in the Episcopal Church records in 1794 to the village of Waterville. That's Hobart was called Waterville up till 1828. So probably, I'm guessing, maybe when the town of Stanford was established in 1792, and maybe Ezra Payne left, possibly, that the name somehow got switched to Waterville. I don't know that for certain, but that's my best guess right now. So the upper dam, if you go down to the lower dam, you see what we call the lower dam, the mill pond, and 1793. There's no sawmill. There are some historical references that the sawmill on that side of the river was built in 1792, but it's not here. So I'm guessing maybe the sawmill wasn't built at that time on the lower dam. Building number 9, I've circled, made some numbers for you. Building number 9 was the grist mill. So the lower dam was built in 1793 by Andrew Beers, according to Munsell's History of Delaware County, and that's consistent with other references. And then he set up a grist mill, it seemed like, pretty much right away, too. There's a building 6 that's right on the edge there that may be covered by the page. Then we cross Water Street. Building 7, I think, was Andrew Beer's house. It's at the corner of Pearl and what they called Water, which became River Street. In 1880, Munsell says Andrew Beer's lived on the corner of River and Pearl Streets, in the house where John Hanford was living at that time in 1880. When we get to the map of 1869, you'll see John Hanford in this location. So I think that may have been Andrew Beer's house. And then we come down Pearl Street to the present-day cemetery. There's a reference to the Glebe lot and the Glebe house, the building number 8 I've referenced. The Glebe was a term used by the Episcopals for church-owned property. In the beginning, I didn't know that. I had to find out, and that when you look at some early things, it's confusing. There's references to Glebe this, Glebe that, and it's all tied into the Episcopal Church. The Glebe house was built in 1800, the summer of 1800, according to the church history, for the minister. They had trouble getting a minister here. They built the church. They built the house for the minister. They built the church the following summer. This is the area of the present-day Locust Hill Cemetery, and we're going to look more closely at this in the next map, but this is the Glebe lot, eventually, over time, became the cemetery. Let me just see. What's interesting, you've noticed, the streets, the names of the streets go back and forth. So we got Water Street for River Street. We got Pine Street, which is today's Maple Avenue. Pearl Street is Pearl Street then. It becomes South Street. And then by the 1860s, and then goes back to Pearl Street sometime later. So the names go back and forth. But, as of 1800, you got four buildings on the Harper's Field side, and you got six buildings on the Stanford side, if this is accurate. And it probably is, based on the census information. But the settlement is developing, and things are moving right along. Any questions about this, these maps at this time? Yeah.
On that map there, down on River Street, down the other end, near where the cemetery is now, where the trailer park is.
Yeah.
There used to be a fairgrounds down there.
Yes. Yes. I've read that.
I don't know what year that was, but I had one of the padlocks come off.
Oh. They talk about it in the 1860s, 1870s. Yeah, I will get, when we get to 1869, I think it may be D.C. Sharp's property in 1869.
That's
but
I,
I have read of that in fact, my mother and I went to the New York State Historical Association Research Library in Cooperstown yesterday, and I found something that referenced, we found something about it, the first fair was 1877. So I think it comes along in that time period.
Yeah.
Maybe earlier, but yes.
There were four buildings and there were four padlocks.
Oh, wow.
And they were marked over the fairground.
Interesting. Any other questions, comments? Okay, let's move to the next one, page 8 and 9, the cemetery. And I have to thank Bill DeSilva for this map. He was the upper part, I've included an insert on the bottom page from 1869 to help with some references, but Bill found the map on the top part of the page in the cemetery records and shared it with me 2 summers ago, and it was most fascinating because I had been doing some work reading about the first cemetery being established with Sarah Beers donating some property, and there were different references to it. I mean, we knew where Sarah Beers' grave was. She's the oldest, the first person buried in Locust Hill. But this one, Bill found this map, and it shows the burying ground. I mean, that tells you, shows you the first part of the Locust Hill Cemetery. And I've written in date. We're going to walk through maybe some of the development. But this map, from the references and things not referenced from what I've done, I think dates from 1817 to 1832. 1816, 1817, 1832, roughly. Now, I think it's at least no older than 1816, 1817 because there are references to a school building being in the northwest corner of it, and I've written that. I've circled that in for you where I'm guessing where that would be. There's a compass there of the directions because you need this when you read these descriptions. The school was there, built in 1805, the first school, it was called the Waterville Academy, and built in 1805, and it burned in 1816. So it was used as a school, and the upper floor was used as the Masonic Lodge, the meetings for the Masonic group that was here. So that building doesn't show on this map. It burned down in 1816, so this map probably was I'm assuming, done after that. But it does show, then moving forward, it shows John Foote's house on the right side. John Foote died in 1834. He was here. He was the son of George Foote. He got married. He had married twice. I think his first marriage was 1811, 1812. And so his house, that's the house today that is Barbara Hoover Stevens' house. And possibly the oldest house in Hobart, people think. And it could be. Why do I say 1832? Let me think. The Glebe House. Remember, we saw the Glebe House on the past map. The Glebe House was the Episcopal minister's home. In 1832, the Episcopals sold it and bought the house on today's Maple Avenue, what we all know was the Episcopal Rectory, right where the railroad tracks used to run. On Maple Avenue, just kitty corner across the street from the bank. So they moved, the minister's house moved from the cemetery area over there to Maple as of 1832. And they said at that time in 1832 they're going to sell the property, they're going to leave some grounds for a cemetery. And so that's, I've written in 1832, I think that's, if that was done, then this map still shows it as being there, so I would guess it's, dates prior to 1832. John Foote, son of George, I put a little bit of information for you. He was the first village blacksmith. He worked, I don't know if he ran or where, he worked in the so-called nail factory that some Hobart history talks about, Hobart making the first nails in the United States, first type of nail. Don Dales asked me about that last year. I did a little bit of work after last year. I can't find anything to substantiate that we indeed, unfortunately, were the first to do it. There are references to other places in New England maybe a year or two earlier than anything. Anyway, I can't document that. There's a lot of activity in making nails in the 1790s in New England, 1795 even. And so we certainly were in the beginning of it if we weren't the first. But John Foote worked, and that nail factory or shop was along the Talbot River, maybe outside of town up by, what's the Allen Wyman farm now, Montgomery Homestead in the old history books, but at that part of the Talbot River. His son, John's son, Fred Foote, born in 1815, died in 1885, was a banker in Hobart, and you'll see when we go through some of the old, later maps, Fred's in this house. So that was the Foote house. The property not identified in the middle was the Cowan Dairy. There's a barn there now, but that's the Cowan Dairy. I'm not exactly sure. Well, this map shows the Glebe property, so it would have the church property lines. I think maybe the cemetery lines run that. I'm not exactly sure of that. But in the development of the cemetery, I've written in the date, so the burying ground, well, the area there, that's 1802. That's Section B today. If you walk into the cemetery, it's up in the back, sort of the center part, but in the back area. The next part, and this is not precise, and Bill, if you can jump in if you know more, but there's a reference that when the school burned in 1816, the land was donated to the cemetery. So that's, I've written that as 1818 there on the left. The Glebe House is in operation in 1832. They sell it. That land becomes cemetery. 1897, Bill has shared this, the deed with me on this. The cemetery, 1897, the Locust Hill Cemetery Company was formally incorporated. The official cemetery and the records were formalized at that point. They bought two parcels of land that year, 2 acres and slightly more of it, sort of what on the east side. So running from, if you think of the road going into the cemetery now along Maple Street towards the old Cowan Dairy, maybe not all of that. I actually just a couple hours ago went up there and walked along in there to look at some of the graves, especially along the road, where the road runs in at Maple right there next to Church Street. And some of the, up until 1826, all the burials, according to Bill's information, were in Section B, up in this burying ground information, in that section. Starting in 1826, there are a few, up in the 1830s, there are some graves along the present-day road on the other side, which is today Section A. But it's right on the edge of the road. So I don't think I wrote this here on my notes. I don't think I wrote in for you. I think the road today runs in right at where the Glebe House is, maybe the H and Glebe House. And the Church Street, coming from the church, comes in at Highway, maybe the HI and Highway there, just so you got a reference. So right where I've written 1832, the road is there. So they start to expand on that side of the road in the 1830s, 1840s. And then even more so in the 1890s. And then they make a big acquisition on the other side, the west side, in 1911, 4 acres from the McNaught family, and that's along the pines and goes down as far as the old railroad tracks. And you can see, and so that's why I included the insert from 1869, sort of help with the roads, and to just give you an idea, that was, you can see the cemetery boundaries at that point before the expansions in 1897 and 1911. This map comes from, and Bill found it, but it's references Don McPherson, who I think somebody here knows better can correct me. I think it was the town of Stamford historian, 1920s, 1930s. His name is in a lot of stuff. And I think he may have done that 1800 map, the copy that we looked at earlier. And so I haven't had a chance, but I'd like to get up. I think that there may be records and files of his in the village of Stamford Library, the village historical association. He was quite active in a lot of this. Just finally, the reference to, you may look back on the development of the cemetery, what I call the first cemetery. In the Episcopal Church records, it's listed chronologically at 1820. And I make a note here whether this should be 1802. They talk about it, and I've quoted here. So Mrs. Sarah Gunn, wife of Andrew Beers, great astronomer, gave land in the southeast part of the cemetery to the church, where she was then buried the next year. Whether she was sick in 1802, she's buried the next year in 1803. I don't know why the Episcopals reference it as 1820. It's out of order, and I'm hoping it's a typo. I don't know, but I'm guessing it is. It makes an interesting reference here too. Then there was obviously some opposition. George Foote started the small cemetery near the Episcopal Church. So he says some opposition about it. So he donated land in that area near the church, and he's buried there. His wife Charity was the first burial there in 1817. And George is buried. Bear with me. This is a typo here. 1822 should be 1820. Apologize, but George is buried there in 1820. But that's the history of the little church by the cemetery, or the little cemetery by the church. Any questions? No, yes.
You said that if George Foote was a taxpayer, what do you have to do to be a taxpayer?
Well, this is from Griffin Town History Town. History of the town of Stamford. I'm not sure. It's a good question. I haven't looked at any of those. I think property owners pay taxes. Business, maybe some sort of business. Griffin makes a lot of references. So he must have seen, I think this is Charles Griffin. If you haven't heard about this, it's a neat little book. I mean, the Adamses do have it for sale. I've got it. It talks about the town of Stamford. It has a tendency to focus on the village because Charles Griffin was in the village. But he wrote it in 1880. And it never got published. And it was found in an attic. I don't know the date. I want to say 1960s, 1970s. It was published in 1980 something. But it was written in 1880. So it has a lot of information. And he makes references. So he must have seen tax records. See, in 1880, it's less than 100 years in the town. So he makes references to the town. He makes references that certain records are no longer available. But I'm guessing it would have to be some sort of tax like that, because he mentions a lot of people as taxpayers. Anything else? We're 10:04. We're doing all right. Let's move on. We're going to move to the 1850s, 1860s. Here I've just put the two maps together. We can look at them together. I've maybe made a couple of circles. I apologize. 1856 is the Jay Gould map. This is the best I have not been able to find. This is a hard map to find. It's a big wall. I think it sits on a wall. It's got all of the villages in Delaware County at the time in the 1850s, and identifies residences and businesses and so forth. I'm sure the Delaware County Historical Group in Delhi has a copy. I've got to try to get. So this is a copy. So it's hard to read. And most importantly, I mean, in the middle, and I'm interested because my family's house is in part of this, but some of these buildings have numbers, and then they're identified in very blurry writing at the bottom, which I've been able to decipher a little bit, but not completely. But let's, and then you got 1869, and that's what Bill Adams was talking about. This is from the Beers Atlas. I actually saw an original one of these yesterday in Cooperstown. They have it. And this is a reasonably good copy I've got here for you. And this identifies a lot of the businesses. Gould doesn't show any street names, whereas 1869, I mean, they do. So now, I mean, Main Street is Main Street, River Street is there, but Pearl Street is South Street. And in fact, when you look at the cemetery records, 1897, everything he talks about, you know, along South Street. I don't know. And Maple Avenue is still Pine Street. Not sure when that change is over. There's no railroad yet in any of this. I have marked in the top of each of them a little squiggly line where I think Cornell Avenue would run, just to give you a little perspective so it runs over. I know on 1869 I'm accurate because the R. Hoos house there is that was right there. That's the MacArthur house. And I believe the 1856 is the right location. But that... So there's no railroad. There's no, that whole, this whole side of and railroad area isn't developed yet. It's probably still all farmland. In 1856, I've just circled the Episcopal Church for you. You know that, but right next to it was the school. So at that time, the school was was on the hill there near the Episcopal Church. This is a school that Jay Gould would have attended, I think, for a few months, maybe a year at the most. It was moved, the building was moved, and some people here will know, but it was moved from there over to Upper Maple Avenue later on. So I think the building still exists, but it's not there anymore. By 1869, there is a school in the location where we know the school to be, today's present school, the school that was built. Not the building that is here today, the community center, but it's on River Street, sort of in the middle of it, between Pine and South. But 1869 shows John Hanford. I think if I didn't circle that, at the corner of River and South. Remember, that's the reference to where Andrew Beers lived earlier. So you got that. The F.W. Foote and Frederick Foote shows on both. That's the John Foote house. So he took over his father's house and stayed in there for years. And for Bill and Barbara Coleman on 1869, you probably know, but way in the upper right, Taylor is your property. That's the Lamports bought from the Taylors, and then the Taylor family owned it for three generations, and I think the Lamports had it for three, I believe. And that's let's see, anything else? Any questions? I hope that, well, it's in 1869, and I just, there's a, right at the, where the page comes in, there's a reference downstream from the lower dam to another mill, a mill site. It's hard to read. I don't know if I wrote, I'm sorry, I wrote it under my notes. It's written in the river. When you go back to the 1800s, 1780s, there's descriptions, the area was called the Mills. Haynes Mills was called the Mills, and there's references to six or seven mills on the various rivers. I haven't, you know, the today's Upper Dam in Hobart, the Lower Dam, probably this location downstream, and apparently a couple on the Town Brook, and maybe one here at the old, what I call the old Creamery, which is now Covidian, but the old Creamery, I think there may have been a mill there as well, there's reference, but it's hard to find. This is the 1780s, 1790s, 1800s time frame.
There's a machine shop and foundry right in the middle of the pond.
Yep.
Where are they getting their power?
I think that's the dam, the upper dam.
From up above?
Well, that's right at the dam. The machine shop was right at the dam.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That's a good question. So the dam is right there, but it's right at the dam. Both of these, it's hard to read on 1856, but in the lower dam, they both show the sawmill on the Route 10 side, as well as the grist mill on this side in the lower dam. So those are there, as well as there was the upper dam had activity as well. Any questions, just as you look at this, or I can decipher a little bit. Yes, Bill?
There must have been a bridge at the bottom of the lower.
Oh yeah.
Where the lower dam was.
Yeah, that was there when I was a kid.
Oh
yeah.
Was it a road?
Yeah. Oh no, the road. Yeah, the road went over. Yeah, the road went over the bridge. You could drive.
Right up the main street.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I think when Main Street, when you come out of the village going up the hill, that's the coffee bar, New York State widened the road, and it made the elevation too steep to go down. It was Mill Hill Road. Mill Hill Road. Yes, but I think it closed after maybe Route 10 got widened, and they got too steep at that. Yes. Yeah, it's been abandoned for quite a while. I remember driving up and down it. I mean, in the 60s, 70s. Yeah, the slaughterhouse. Yep.
Right.
Yep. That was there. So,
And where Mill Hill Road was, there's like a stand of trees that are right next to each other, straight, right down the hill. Would that have lines where the road was?
Yes.
I think so, yes. I actually walked down it just a couple hours ago. I hadn't been out there in a while, but it's a tree. I'm not sure if it is that.
Yeah.
It could be.
I remember that because I was dead all that time. It was standard shift. You're like this, waiting out on 10. And I was marveled at your coordination because you're singing like that.
No, you were. It was very steep.
It says here we're just looking to the engine house.
Yes.
What's that?
That's the fire station.
Jim, isn't that where Benny Rothenberg had his meat packing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it is.
Or was it? It was Benny, wasn't it?
I read that. I think it was Benny in there, yeah.
Along
the river, yes. Yes, on the slaughterhouse. I think that may be the building that's still left. It's still standing. It's pretty dilapidated, but yeah.
That's pretty steep for it.
Well, yeah, there's been a question up front. On 1869 on River Street, right above the word street, you see the reference engine house. And that's the old firehouse. So, and remember, this is 1869. The what was the old firehouse across the street here was built in the 1880s. We're going to see that in a little bit. But I believe... And there's actually a store there on the corner, but there was a firehouse in there, and there was a road into there, but that is a steep embankment.
Yeah.
Yep. Let me see. But, yes. Might be. There were when I was a kid. I don't think they live here anymore, do they? Are there any foots? I don't know. There's. Okay. Oh, okay. I mean, Eddie Foote III was a couple years older than me when I was growing up, and his father. And then the Foots were still active in the 60s and 70s in various businesses, so... Yeah, they were still pretty prominent. Let's move on to the next one. So page 12 and 13, the last two pages. This is from the 1890s into the 1920s, the Sanborn Insurance Company, I think out of New York City, published insurance maps. Published maps for the insurance business, basically to help, you know, with for business areas primarily, to help, you know, cover insurance coverage and so forth. And bear with me if you use it. Some of this may be copyrighted. I mean, I'm not sure about 1927. So I've just come across these. I've been aware of these. And, in fact, the Hobart Historical Society has a few of these. So for Hobart, they were published in there's six years, 1891, 1898, 1904, 1912, 1927. I may have missed one. That's only five. Anyway, every 6, 7, 10 years they put them out. The first, and so I haven't given you all of them, but we're going to look at Main Street area. We got 1891 and 1927. And I chose 1927 because the footprint of the buildings very similar to what we know today. The main buildings in along Main Street, some are gone, but some of the other ones that we know, whereas when you look at 1891, you don't see some of the buildings that we know today, or at least there. Now, as we look at both of these, I've highlighted, if you see a building with an X in it, that's a stable. It was a barn or a stable for horses. and there's a fair number of them. You know, and they sort of go along with each house or each business. It's sort of interesting because there's a lot of them in 1891. And you also, and I don't think I highlighted for you, but the post office moves around. So if you look in 1891, it's toward the top here. It's got P.O. on Main Street on the right-hand side. Don, that's where you got your car, I think, now. That's your garage. Yeah. So I didn't know that. And then in over in 1927, it's down by across the street from Leo. Today's Leo's. I think the old, well, I knew it was a blue and white restaurant as a kid, but the house is still there. I think that house is still standing. And in between this time, and Wally, you can help me if you know, but it was down along, right at the end, in well, what I knew as the Grand Union Building, but J.B. Rich Building, I think in the early 1900s, the post office.
Yeah.
So down at the end of Main Street as it turns into Maple. Maybe, I think maybe almost the last building shown on both of them there, at Main Street and Maple. The post office was down there in between these two maps. These are amazingly, I tried to blow these up. I apologize, it's still the print may still be a little hard to read, but I did blow it up a little bit. But the detail is interesting. And they referenced the businesses and what was there at the time. So I think Adams Bookstore, 1891, I think is referenced as the hardware. There, just below, right below Robin, the reference to Robinson. That's my guess. Well, the foundry shows up in 1927, but I'm not sure. But what interests me is the coffee pot. It was a billiards hall, 1891. Yeah. That I didn't know until I saw this map. These maps are not available to the on the computer personally, but if you go to a library, has access. I was able to go to the University of Buffalo Library just a month or so ago, and through the library you could access them for free, and I was able to download them all. I was able to print them and able to. I did it for this because I wanted to have reference for them today.
What are they called again?
Sanborn Insurance Digital. If you go online, Google Sanborn Digital Maps, you'll pull it up. It's done for every major locality during the times. It's pretty interesting. What is interesting now, by this time the railroad is here, and both maps on the right hand side show some railroad tracks. 1891. And this pretty much only shows two lines, two spurs, whereas if you look over by 1927, 30 years later, 35, I mean, there's a few extra tracks. And that's partly, well, two things, I think. The two largest users of the railroad in these days were Sheffield Creamery and the Van Buren feed coal lumber business. And you can see, if you compare 1891, there's a feed business, but 1927, Van Buren feed and coal has really grown. I believe Edgar T. Van Buren bought out a local feed business in the early 1900s, 1905, 1906. So by the 1920s, I mean, if you see there, there's a lot of activity. And then, well, right here, basically. It's right here where we are.
Right here.
Right around and back here. And they had some extra lines. So they would have spurs off the main line for the feed business and for the creamery. If you look, I mean, again, in 1927, I mean, by then, what's identified as King's Garage, sort of in the middle, I think it's the flowers and now the Delaware propane. And then further down, you see the, is it E.R. Davis? E.R. Davis, I mean, that's the old Schaller's supermarket, the meat store now, next to Adams Books. But see, you can see, if you compare the maps, those buildings were built between the 1890s by 1927. I think one of those actually was built in 1927.
That was the garage.
What? I think, yes. Okay. I think you're right. I think, yep, I remember seeing that. It was right.
Davis built that one.
Yep. Okay. Anything? Anybody having trouble reading something? Any questions I can help for? We got one more map. It's 4:10. We got one more. We're just about done. No? Let's turn over to the last page. This is just sort of a favorite of mine. We've lived on the playground. I grew up on the playground. I played golf. I played baseball. So here's the village playground area and surroundings in 1912 and 1927. And it's just, so 1912, I mean, there is no playground. It's still private property. What was called the Marvin Cottage. So during the railroad in this era, there were a lot of boarding houses in the Hobart. People would come up out of the city, into Stamford, you know, Stamford especially, and then the Hobart. And Marvin Cottage was one of those boarding houses. And it was on what is today the playground area. It burned, and I found a reference in the Oneonta Star
And I, so it burned in February 11th, just, well, the anniversary date, 1918. So, and I don't know for sure, but by 1927, it turned into the playground. So I'm guessing maybe after that building burned. I've also seen, you'll notice there's another building just to the upper left of it on the playground area. There's a reference in a Hobart historical publication that that building was moved off the playground to, actually, I think to the Montgomery Homestead, the Weinman Farm area. So perhaps then by the 1920s, and the present day school building that's there was built in 1921, so it shows up in 1927. It was a different school prior to that, from 1887. So maybe it was a school expanded, and then we have the athletic and playground facility. And then also by 1927, the Presbyterian Church, on the right-hand side, has been built on Maple Avenue. It wasn't; it was built there 1913, 1914. So most of the other houses, most of the other buildings in the area are you know, the same. But that's the development of the playground.
I think you'll find the houses in our end of town were built in the 1800s, 1880s. Because when we did over our bedroom, we found a penny on the study between the front windows of
1882. 1880, yeah. Yeah, that could be. Oh, I said, yeah. Well, you got even, you know, even that 1869 map has your, I mean, because you go up to Taylor. Are you above Coleman?
We're above Coleman.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm sorry. Yeah. No, it doesn't show much there. You're right.
No.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. So you're right. It probably could be later. That, yes. Please.
In the early days, how was ownership established? Cause I've had learned some stuff. I'm from the eastern part of Delaware County, and a lot of the people there were given property to work. If they worked it, they could live on it. I don't know if they actually owned it in the old days. I don't know. Is this
I haven't done a lot on that, but yes, I mean, that's, and that, so if you go back to that original, the 1780s map, you know, the survey, I mean, you'll find these, and they were complicated leases. That's what led to the, I think, and I have not done a lot of research, but it led to the anti-rent wars by the 1840s, because these property owners out of New York City essentially leased the property, never sold it to the people, leased it to them. You know, family on some things like three family leases, so for three generations, and then they were, I mean, and it was very onerous. Well, it was very unfair, I think, to the people living on the property. But I haven't, in all honesty, just haven't been able to do a lot on that. And that's, I mean, you do find that people did buy the property as they come through. So I think it depended on maybe the individuals and what was going on, but. You do have that. You have the same thing, I think, throughout most of Delaware County, maybe, or not even just Delaware County, most of New York State, this area of New York. That covers all my maps for now, and we're about an hour, so thank you.
Well, it's just wonderful how you allow us to put our village in its place in history.
It's fast. It's fun to look at it too. I enjoy doing it.
If there can be more questions, otherwise.
Yeah, I'm going to stick around. So please, if there's any individual.
Diana, did you want
to? We want to see. We have four heart-shaped cakes. The one that I couldn't write, I love Hobart. Next year it's We Heart June.
Yeah.
So we have a mandarin orange heart-shaped cake, a date nut heart-shaped cake, and two white cakes, Cool Whip, fudge, cream cheese.
Is this the
mandarin is the middle one.
Most of the house is mandarin white town.
And actually, we also have and for all of you, drank the first pot of coffee. I apologize.
Oh, you got
I made a second pot. I hope it's better. I've tried it.
You
I'm
got,
still alive. We'll never thank you enough for
okay. Well.
So you'll be able to read the name.
Yeah, I'm interested to see the Hobart part. But, yeah.
Thank you.
No, I enjoyed it. Thanks very much. I appreciate it. It's fun.
Did you say these maps are available here or is this at the shop?
Just at our shop. Probably made in the back there. Fellow just talking about. And so we made a few. And there are a couple. I mean, these are available.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know what? I think that's what we're going to do.
Suggested that the price is 25 unlaminated, 40 laminated, because they have a laminated.
That might be kind of interesting.